I'd like to call this to order. I'd like to call March 1st, 2022, Planning and Zoning Commission to order. Ms. Okpona, would you give us a roll call?
Commissioner Bergsma?
Here.
Commissioner Henderson?
Here. Do you get me? I'm here, Bob Henderson.
Gotcha. Thank you. Okay. Vice Chair Harrington?
Here.
Commissioner Posey?
Here.
Commissioner Sturman?
Here.
And Chair Gamble?
Here.
Let the record show we have a quorum.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to call, pledge allegiance. Please stand. Good evening. Thank you for joining us tonight. We are glad to continue to meet in person, but recognizing that COVID cases in our area, a state nation, increases substantially. I'm aware that Pima County has just dropped their mandate, but we are emphasizing the importance of responsibility citizens and gathering like these by urging, indeed mandating, the mask worn properly over the nose and mouth. I thank those who are opting to heed that advice. I personally urge anyone who not currently wearing a mask to take advantage of masking provided dispenser near by the door. Regardless of your vaccine status, we want your respective health of your participants and public meeting their families and loved ones by doing what you can to mitigate the spread of the virus. Thank you for your cooperation. A few housekeeping items. The restrooms can be found out to the right of the front double doors. There's a drinking fountain located next to the restrooms. The agenda tonight are study session, discussion items only. There's no public hearing. If anyone wishes to address the commission during the call of audience, please feel free to fill out a blue card located in the back and hand in to the recording secretary, Ms. Okpona. I have reviewed these agenda items in order to remain posted. Any call to order? Call to audits?
No, I don't have any.
No blue cards. Thank you. Okay, we'll close call to the audience. I'd like to introduce our Mayor Winfield's here tonight with us. Definitely an honor. And we also have our vice mayor here. I'd like to now turn it over to our council liaison, Mayor Barrett, Vice Mayor Barrett.
If I may, Vice Mayor, sorry to interrupt. Can we ask you to please come up and use a microphone? We're not able to record what you're saying. Sorry to interrupt. Whatever works.
Thank you, Vice Mayor Barrett. Let's see, where are we? Okay, maybe we have Mr. Conan read the first agenda item.
Review and approval of the February 1st, 2022 regular session meeting minutes.
I make a motion that we approve the minutes, February 1 minutes.
I'll second the motion.
Any opposed?
Mr. Chair, could we, Vice Chair, could we have a ask for a vote? If you want a roll call, you can, or you can ask for ayes and nays, and we'll get there.
Can I get a roll call, Mr. Kona?
Commissioner Bergsma?
Yes.
Commissioner Henderson?
I think I'm unmuted. This is Robert Henderson. I vote yes.
Thank you. Commissioner Posey?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturman?
Yes.
Vice Chair Harrington?
Yes.
And Chair Gamble?
Yes.
Motion passes 6-0.
Ms. Okona, will you please read the agenda item number 2?
Discussion regarding a proposed zoning code amendment to the sign standards for banner and window signs, section 28, and other related sections, including definitions, chapter 31.
Ready? All right.
Yes.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for your time tonight. All right, the purpose for this item is to review proposed changes to the sign standards of the zoning code, specifically for banners and window signs. A few months ago, the town took steps to help our local businesses during the beginning of the pandemic by relaxing some of our sign standards. This program allowed businesses to utilize signage as needed to help keep their doors open during the pandemic. After several months of allowing those relaxed sign standards, we learned a few lessons. First, it became clear just how important signage is for small businesses, in particular, window and banner signs. This triggered an effort to review how the code could be amended to be more user-friendly and equitable among businesses while maintaining the expected Oro Valley standards. So I wanted to mention one thing right off the bat is in your packets this evening, you've got attachment 1 for this case. Attachment 1 is a very large document. It's the entire sign code. Lots of pages. And if you took a look at it, you may have seen lots of pages marked up. So it looks like a lot. But really what we're doing is changing the standards for banner and window signs only. The rest of it is just housekeeping. For example, all the sign definitions. We're moving them out of Chapter 28 and over to Chapter 31 to go live with all the rest of the zoning code definitions. So all of that markup looks like a lot, but really it's only a couple of pages in this document that we're concentrating on. So I don't want you to get too scared of the big document there. So first, let's look at banners. Banners seem to be used quite frequently by many businesses. However, our code currently treats new businesses better than existing, by allowing a new business to install a large banner, similar to what we see in this photo. And that might sound nice at first, unless you're an existing business. Then you're only allowed to install a small banner. A small banner size is not too helpful for businesses who are trying to keep their doors open. Staff is proposing to allow one banner size for all businesses. We learned that allowing all businesses, new and existing, to use one large banner size created an equality among businesses while making things simpler for the store owners and our code enforcement. And we also made a minor change to the special event banner size, reducing that from 64 down to 60 square feet, just for simplification. And also, in keeping with the simplification approach, we're proposing that a store owner could obtain one banner permit for the entire year instead of multiple permits throughout the year. And the table on the right highlights in the red circles the changes to the proposed banner sizes. Basically, one size for all. This is a mock-up of what the banner changes might look like. On the left is the currently allowed small banner for an existing business. On the right is the proposed 60-square-foot banner size that would be available to everyone. Staff is proposing to standardize the sizes to the 60 square foot size allowance. The overall effect still appears to be a reasonable size, and the 60 square foot banner allows the smallest of stores to be noticed from the largest of parking lots. All right, next let's look at the other most used sign type, which is window signs. Businesses tend to like to utilize their stores, much like we would see in these photos, to further identify their business. Currently, our window sign standards are perhaps the most micromanaged part of our sign code. We dictate the size and location of each component of the window, such as the store name, the hours of operation, the little poster size display area, the little band of wording that goes across the front of the store and where it can be located, and so on. So in keeping with the theme of simplifying, staff proposes to allow all businesses to simply use a percentage of their storefront for window signs, as shown in the yellow highlighted areas on this table. We propose eliminating the micromanaging aspect of telling a store owner the size of each component of their window sign, and instead just allow them to use 30% of their windows for signage. So this is a mock-up of what the window sign changes might look like. On the left, again, is what the code currently allows, which is very limited sizes for each component of the window sign, such as the hours of operation, the name, the sign band, and where it can be located, and all that. On the right is what the proposed changes might look like, simply allowing a percentage of the window to be used for signage without the micromanaged regulations currently in place. The overall goal for window signs is not to cover up the entire window, but to allow a business to provide information about their business while keeping a clear line of sight in and outside the store. The general plan action item asks that we update signage much like we're reviewing tonight. The proposed code amendment is very focused on two sign types, banners and windows, which will contribute to the identification of businesses and their long-term success. To summarize, the proposed sign standards are simply to allow one banner size for all businesses and one method of measurement for window signs. The proposed standards will make both banner and window signs easier to understand for businesses and clearer for code enforcement. And so back to that thick document, basically only pages 45 through 51 have the meat and potatoes of tonight's code amendment. The rest is all housekeeping. And so tonight is a study session, and we look forward to your feedback. Thank you.
Thank you. Does any of the commissioners have any questions for staff? Commissioner, you may proceed.
Thank you. So two questions. The first is in terms of illumination of window signs. As I read it, the only window sign that could be illuminated would be an open closed sign. Is that correct?
Actually, Mr. Bergsmed, that's incorrect. Currently, the code allows the business to have their open and closed sign illuminated. And currently, they can have a 6-square-foot display area illuminated. So basically a poster size display area. We are proposing to continue that same standard. So if they were allowed to use 30% of their windows for signage, still only 6 square foot of that could be illuminated, and their open and closed sign. Same standards.
And the illumination would have to be constant. It couldn't be blinking or some other way of attracting attention?
That is correct, sir. There is no blinking, moving, rotating, flashing, and all that.
Great. The other question I have is it looks like you're trying to move in the same direction or be consistent with what Pima County does in terms of at least banner signs. I'm not sure if that's true of window signs. Did you look at the other larger jurisdictions near Oro Valley, Marana, and Tucson, and how they're dealing with these kinds of signs?
Yes, sir. We actually did look at several other jurisdictions, and percentage seems to be the way they go for window signs. A lot of them are percentage of window signs. Instead of, like I said, right now we micromanage every little tiny component of the window signs. Didn't find that a lot of other places. It just seemed to be a percentage, and that was anywhere from 25% to 40%, depending on the jurisdiction.
In terms of banner signs, if a business had different outlets or locations, in the region, one in Tucson, one in Oro Valley, one in Marana, so on. And they wanted to order banners for all their stores. Would they be able to order the same kind of banner for each store, or would they have to change the banner depending on the location?
As long as it met the size, the square footage of our standards, that's what they would have to order for us. I couldn't answer to their other locations.
But in terms of us, we would at least be consistent with Pima County.
This is
for banner sizes.
Pretty close to Pima County standards, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Brisma. Is there any other follow-up questions? Commissioner Posey?
I was just wondering if there's any color restrictions.
Ms. Posey, no, there aren't color restrictions as long as they don't mimic traffic signs. So we don't want that fluorescent, iridescent, reflective stuff. That's basically the only color restriction.
Thank you.
Chair Harrington. Thank you. I noticed that you focused in on windows and also banners. What about figurines that are outside of the entrance of the store? Now, have we addressed that? Sometimes they come up with posters of images of people holding something. And so could you help me with that?
Mr. Sturman, the figurines outside the store, that would fall into the outdoor display. And we do have a code section that addresses that and tries to limit them from getting too much, but allowing them a little bit.
So what is the minimum or maximum? Is it 6 feet high?
For the outdoor display? You know, I don't have that with me tonight. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
The other question I have is, so I was looking at your window examples, and I apologize. Those look like they're larger than 30% of the window that it's set in. Am I missing the point?
The example on the right measured out to 30%, which was, ironically, for this example, they, with using the 30% measurement, I think they got about a 6-square-foot additional sign area on this particular storefront. We actually have this awesome little computer program that measures out this stuff, so
So the window sign on the lower portion, that looks bigger than 30%. So is it the whole entire from top to bottom, which you're allowing the 30%, or would it be the individual panes that it's in?
Oh, thank you for that question. It'd actually be the overall store frontage. Whatever their overall window frontage is, it would be 30% of that. So they could, in this particular instance, they could opt to fill an entire pane there if they wanted to, if that was no more than 30%.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further questions for any of the commissioners? I know we have two commissioners online, so I want to make sure and give them ample time to unmute.
I would like to actually bring up an additional item. So with the banners, we're pretty much talking about banners that are hung on the storefront. Our code does allow a business to still use a freestanding banner, and that's a banner they can put out by the property line. And we're proposing to continue to allow that. But that's at a smaller 16-square-foot size always. So if they chose not to do a wall sign, they could do the smaller freestanding sign still. There's no change proposed to that. Just wanted to clarify that in case anybody asked.
Any additional questions?
I didn't have a question. This is Chair Gamble, but I was really excited to see this update. I think it will be really great for a lot of the small businesses we have. So I will just add that as I was going through, I was really pleased to see the changes and allowing our small businesses this extra opportunity. So thank you, town staff.
Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner Posey?
Yes, I agree with Chair Gamble. To look at the old, well, not the old, the existing codes, they seem to be very strict and a little confusing to me. And I think these proposed, this proposal, I looked at it looks very much better. And like I said, I agree with Chair Gamble that it would be great for our businesses. You know, and the old businesses will have an advantage as well. So
thank you.
Well, I'll just say that I concur. I'm all for simplification, and this is headed in the right direction.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Akona, could we have the next agenda item?
Discussion regarding proposed code amendments to revise the development review process.
Good evening. My name is Melanie Sims, and I'm a principal planner with the Town of Oro Valley. So our purpose of this item is to discuss another proposed code amendment, but this time to the development review process. So development review includes a site, landscape, architecture, art, and sign designs for commercial and residential developments, developing within their existing zoning allowances. This means the projects are permitted by the zoning as it relates to building height, use, setbacks, and more, and must be approved if code compliant. An example of a project currently going through the development review process is the Stone Canyon 9 subdivision that the commission considered last month. Our goal tonight is to provide you with more information about what changes are being proposed and why, then gather your feedback and questions to further refine the language to bring back for recommendation at a later date. The proposed code amendment is one of many steps the town is taking to improve efficiency. Another example is a new electronic permitting system, which will soon be implemented. So several key points of the proposed code amendment that I will explain and repeat throughout my presentation include the benefits to all participants in the development review process. This includes residents, staff, applicants, and decision makers. The proposed code amendment benefits all by shortening the review process while maintaining the number of opportunities and effectiveness of public participation. It accomplishes this by requiring more details upfront to eliminate a technical review by staff. Many projects that the commission has recently considered have gone through the proposed process as it has been field tested over the past year within the confines of the existing zoning allowance. The proposed amendment also reduces confusion by revising the terms Oro Valley uses to describe the review process to language more common in the region. With that stated, this amendment is solely focused on process and does not reduce or change any requirements to make sure Oro Valley's high quality of design is maintained. The code amendment includes some additional process-related items to add clarification, specifically with regard to master development plans applicability and the threshold for modifying architecture designs that were previously approved. Lastly, it removes requirements that are redundant and outdated or conflict with state law. Again, I will be going through each in my presentation. So looking at the existing development review process, as shown on the screen, it includes three steps. The first step, or conceptual design review, is a public review process. It includes neighborhood meetings, technical review by staff for code compliance, planning and zoning commission consideration, and ultimately town council approval. The next two steps are likely less familiar to the public, as both include technical reviews by staff. After council approval, the applicant submits a final version of the conceptual design that includes more refined details for grading, traffic, and drainage. During this step, staff conducts another technical review for code compliance and compliance with the conceptual designs that were previously approved. The last tip is the construction plan review. These plans detail the specific improvements needed to develop the site, such as paving and grading. Staff reviews these plans prior to issuing grading permits. The original intent of the current three-step process was to provide an avenue for more effective resident input by receiving it earlier in the process before applicants invested too much money into their designs. However, as you can see on the screen, the level of detail provided during the first step, or that conceptual design review step, and the second step, or the final design review step, are very similar. The image on the left is what the commission is used to seeing, which is more detailed than what was originally intended, but most applicants need to include the grading, drainage, and traffic information to know if a project is feasible and answer resident and decision makers' questions. The image on the right is what staff reviews after council approval. The amount of detail, additional details provided, is minimal between that image and the image on the left. Therefore, the proposed process eliminates the second staff technical review. As you can see on the screen, the public participation process is not being changed. Neighborhood meetings, Planning and Zoning Commission, and Town Council consideration will still happen. The difference it proposed is after Town Council approval, an applicant can submit construction plans to get grading permits. The proposed process has the potential to save staff and applicants a minimum of 6 months. The timeframe shown on the screen includes several variables, such as the amount of neighborhood meetings required, complexity of the project, and the applicant's ability to address comments and resubmit plans quickly. Staff has a standard review deadlines that we consistently meet, so our focus of the process change is on the step that we can control. The proposed process, again, has been field tested over the past year within the confines of the existing code. Developers have asked to combine their final design and construction plans into one submittal, and by doing so, they have tested out the proposed process and shown that the public participation remains effective, and if not more than originally intended with the existing process, and that the need for multiple and similar technical staff reviews is unnecessary. In addition to shortening the development review time, the proposed process also reduces confusion. The terms conceptual and final design are unique to Oro Valley. Often, new consultants take longer to get through the development review process because they are also trying to learn our terminology. Additionally, the terms are uncommon and confusing to outside review agencies that the town works with, such as the Arizona Department of Transportation and Pima County Recording and Addressing Offices. The proposed process used terms more common to the region, such as Master Development Plan, Preliminary Plat, and Development Plan. A Master Development Plan creates a site design for a larger area of land. So most commercial centers in town have Master Development Plans. An example is Steam Pump Village. Preliminary plats provide the site and landscape design for subdivisions. They're what break up or subdivide the lots. Whereas development plans provide the site and landscape designs for individual projects that do not require a subdivision of land. In addition to applicants, residents are also confused as to what amount of detail will be provided and when. The proposed amendment requires more details upfront to address questions about items such as drainage and traffic. Again, the commission is already seeing this level of detail on plans, and the community's ability to provide effective input is being maintained. The code amendment does not change any of the design standards, but rather it reconfigures the timing of when information is received. This is visually depicted with the graphic on the screen. As you can see, the design plans required now will all still be required with the proposed process. The main difference is more details are provided upfront prior to commission and council consideration, and technical details such as irrigation and rainwater harvesting are provided during the construction plan phase. Again, there is no reduction to the level of planning required. The proposed process also provides an opportunity to add clarity within the existing process. So currently, a master development plan isn't required for larger areas of land. However, the proposed process will require one to ensure there is a cohesive design for an entire site. This is important when there's multiple buildings and circulation to plan. Secondly, the proposed code amendment refines the threshold for changes to previously approved architecture designs. Currently, the code defines any change that is greater than 25% as substantial, which must be reconsidered by the Planning and Zoning Commission or Council. The proposed code amendment clarifies this criteria to specify that the 25% is a change to the building facade or the amount of model homes. Additionally, the proposed amendment further defines what a substantial change is, and that is one that does no longer conforms to the design standards to the same extent that was done with the previously approved design, or a change that would impact streetscape, adjoining properties, or compatibility, or affect compatibility. Lastly, the proposed code amendment updates other redundant and outdated processes in the code. So first, a sign criteria provides a code-compliant sign design standards for a multi-tenant center. Individual businesses proposing a code-compliant sign can acquire a sign permit approvable by staff. Yet centers proposing a code-compliant sign design standards for their center require Planning and Zoning Commission approval. The most recent sign criteria the commission approved was for the Oro Valley Business and Self-Storage Center. The proposed process seeks to allow sign criteria to be administratively approved since they are code compliant. Another process proposed for change is a requirement for the town to conduct an annual inventory of all parcels with zoning that conflicts with the general plan's land use map. So that we're all on the same page, zoning includes the development standards and uses legally permitted on the site, whereas the general plan's land use provides policy in the community's vision for the town. The general plan, including the land use map, is updated every 10 years and ratified by the voters. This is the appropriate time to conduct the inventory and make changes with the property owner's consent if deemed necessary. In addition to the inventory, the code currently requires the town to take action on properties with conflicting zoning and land use. An example of action includes independently rezoning a property without a property owner's consent. This section of code was established before the state law passed Proposition 207. Proposition 207 requires a jurisdiction to reimburse a property owner when a zoning change reduces the market value of their property. Independently rezoning private property has a high potential to conflict with Proposition 207. As such, the proposed code amendment removes this requirement completely. I also want to note that most of the properties with zoning that's not in conformance with the land use are permitted in every district. This includes schools, government facilities, and churches. Additionally, all requests to rezone property must be in compliance with the general plan or request a general plan amendment as well. This is the most appropriate process for resolving these conflicts. In summary, again, the proposed code amendment benefits all participants in the development review process. At the application stage, businesses, consultants, and developers will experience a shorter development review time that reflects what many have asked to do and has been field tested within the confines of the existing code. It also requires a level of detail that they are accustomed to needing to know if their project is feasible. During the public review process, residents and community members benefit by getting more details up front and answers to their questions. Again, the amount and effectiveness of public participation is maintained through the proposed process. Both the reduced review time and amount of details provided benefit staff and outside reviewers during this technical review, and similar to residents, decision makers benefit from having more details up front to answer questions. At the completion stage, the shortened review time and level of detail provided about each project during the public review process benefits both existing and future residents as well as community members. And as with any code amendment, we do look to the general plan for guidance. The proposed code amendment meets the goals and policies related to public input by requiring more information upfront to address residents' questions and maintaining the amount of effective public participation opportunities. Additionally, since the amendment is focused on process and not changing or reducing design requirements, it also maintains several of the general plan's guiding principles. And lastly, the proposed amendment supports the Town Council's strategic leadership plan's objective to be more business-friendly. Again, several developers have asked to test the proposed process as permitted within the confines of the existing zoning. The proposed amendment, again, is focused on process. It has been field tested within the confines of the existing zoning code to show it shortens the review process yet maintains the amount of effective public participation. It reduces confusion by using industry terms, but does not reduce or change requirements for quality design. Lastly, it adds clarification and updates other processes that are redundant, outdated, or conflict with state law. This concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to hear your feedback and answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sims. Does any commissioners have any questions or comments? Commissioner Bridgman.
Thank you, Chair Harrington. So basically what you're talking about is changing the development review process after it leaves the public portion of the process, after it goes through review by the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Town Council. We're not changing anything at the conceptual stage, right?
Vice Chair Harrington, Commissioner Bergsma, that is correct. So the public review process is not being changed other than for sign criterias, which would just be changing that from Planning and Zoning Commission approval to administrative. But for the main development review process, we are not changing neighborhood meetings, commission, or council consideration.
And I think you're headed in the right direction, especially if you could cut the process by 6 months. That's wonderful. Did you give any thought to changing the conceptual review process?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that last part?
Well, the mask doesn't help. Did you give any thought to changing the conceptual review process?
Sure. So, Vice Chair Harrington, Commissioner Bergsma, you know, we did look at other jurisdictions, there are several jurisdictions that if a project is entitled, so they're developing within their zoning allowances, they do not do a public review process. We did not change that at this time, but, you know, that is something to maybe think of for the future. But that was kind of the main nuance that our difference that we still saw that Oro Valley does versus other jurisdictions.
The one thing I've sort of thought that's curious about the Oro Valley process is you have neighborhood meetings before they submit the application, and then you have another neighborhood meeting after you submit the application. Seems to me that is unnecessary, that, you know, they're trying to get feedback before they finalize their submittal, which is understanding, but once they've submitted and it's ready for review and going to through the public process, it seems to me that you shouldn't have another neighborhood meeting. Any further input should occur through the public process. And so that if you want to look at anything in that part of the process, that would be at that second neighborhood meeting. Another comment or question I have is, again, in relation to the conflict between the zoning map and the land use map. How many situations do we have like that in the town now?
Vice Chair Harrington, Commissioner Bergsma, there are 52 sites that have zoning that is not matching their land use.
So I can understand, because of Proposition 207, why you wouldn't want to try to change the zoning without the property owner's consent. Has any consideration been given to changing the land use map to be consistent with the zoning?
Sure. So, Commissioner Bergsma, the appropriate time to do that would actually be with the general plan update. So 10 years ago, if you can believe it, we're almost there, 10 years ago, they did the same inventory, looked at different where land uses were mismatching. And for most of those, the committee at the time felt that, no, we're not going to change it during the general plan creation process. It's better to do a general plan amendment process and have it go to the public for the neighborhood meeting, commission, and council. But that doesn't mean that none of them could be changed. But really, the appropriate time to make that change would be when we update the general plan.
Okay, I could sort of understand that. But to me, where you have an inconsistency, this creates confusion. Now, what is it that the town really wants? And so, you know, if the town really wants what is shown on the land use plan, and they just can't change it because of Proposition 207, you know, I guess it's okay to keep that. But again, it just creates confusion.
Sure, and Commissioner Bergsma, I should just, to go a little bit more into the details, I believe only 6 or 7 are undeveloped. So most of those sites that are conflicting, they're developed already with subdivisions or commercial developments or their parks, government facilities, churches, schools. There's not too many that are undeveloped.
If I may, Vice Chair, Member Bergsma, I do recall the last general plan. There were several properties where we did just what you suggested. You know, there were some corrections relative to existing zoning, doing it in the reverse manner. So the sense was on the others that it was certainly not a planning term, but there's an element of let sleeping dogs lie. Relative to the public vote process. And if you don't mind, I'd like to hop back to your previous question, because I think important information that might be you might find helpful as far as the second neighborhood meeting requirement. So just so the commission's aware, the code actually doesn't require an automatic second neighborhood meeting in all circumstances. It enables the planning and zoning administrator to end at 1. Let's say it's a very simple project. There's a meeting. There was no concerns expressed by neighbors. Everything seems spot on. Or no one showed up for the meeting. It's not automatic that a second meeting has to be done. It's normal to do a second one. It's more unusual to have that call of just do one. The code does also enable the planning administrator to require more than 2 meetings. So great example, Oro Valley Marketplace, really big project, lots of interest. So there was a requirement to go well beyond 2. We also did those focus area meetings. So there's flexibility built into that code section. So it's not written in a one-size-fits-all manner.
So in the case of the Oro Valley Marketplace, were all those meetings occurring before they submitted, or were they occurring after as well?
So the code does provide for all projects, including Oro Valley Marketplace, that you do a meeting before submitting. So it's we call it the pre-submittal neighborhood meeting. And that's really, you know, to learn what issues are out there before we really start, the applicant and staff really start taking a deep dive on the technical bits. So Ms. Sims, you may need to help me here that we had the 1 prior pre-submittal meeting, and then I believe we had 4 focus area meetings after formal submittal. Don't really remember which one it was, am I right? Okay. And then we had a last formal large neighborhood meeting after those 4.
Okay, that helps. I mean, I don't have a problem with having multiple neighborhood meetings. To me, it would make more sense to have those occur before submittal and then go right directly to the public process through the Planning Commission and Town Council. But, you know, I guess I'm sort of relating back to my previous experience as a planner in another state, where actually you had to get, once submittal, the application had been accepted as complete, then the jurisdiction had 120 days to get to approval or make a decision. So here there's not that limitation, so things can drag out longer. But to me, it's always important to speed it up as much as possible.
Any other questions? Any other commissioners with any questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Sims.
Thank you.
Ms. Acona, could you please read out the next agenda item?
Discussion and possible action to initiate a zoning code amendment to revise the development standards in the R6 multifamily zoning district.
Hello.
Ms. Sims?
So, our purpose with this item is to request initiation of a zoning code amendment to revise the development standards in an R6 zoning district. So the R6 zoning district is the town's highest density district, which accommodates several housing types ranging from detached and attached single-family homes to apartments. The commission has heard from staff and other commissioners about the concept of the missing middle housing, or low-rise, high-density housing products. Recently, the town received three applications to develop such housing types, with both attached and detached single-family residential products, all subject to the R6 standards. It was clear then that the setbacks and recreation requirements were intended for large, compact apartment buildings, not the other housing types that are currently permitted within an R6 zone. Specifically, the setbacks from adjacent developments and roadways are unclear, as well as the setbacks between buildings are unlike any other zoning districts, and also conflict with the expectations of high-density residential. The recreation requirements are also consolidated to one large space, which doesn't always isn't best suited for your detached or attached single-family housing product. Again, that low-density, high-rise, or low-rise, high-density product. So this request is only to initiate a code amendment. Approval tonight is not approving any new code language. Approval only directs staff to conduct the necessary research and draft code language, which will then be brought back to the commission for recommendation at a later date. I'm now happy to answer any questions you may have about this item.
Thank you, Ms. Sims. Any questions from the commissioners?
So when you say detached, attached, single-family products, are you talking about duplexes, triplexes, things like that? That's another term for it?
Yes, Commissioner Bergsma, that is correct. So it's a mix of duplexes with shared walls, with smaller homes as well that may be detached, but all in one development as more of a rental development.
Oh, cottages as well, there's another term?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Any other questions, Commissioner Bergman? Any other questions from the other commissioners? Commissioner Posey?
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what this is, the distance between a single-story and two-story structure, 15 feet. So there's no difference between a one-story and two-story, or am I looking at that wrong?
Vice Chair Harrington, Commissioner Posey, no, that's a great question. So right now the setbacks in our R6 zoning district are based on building height. So if you're a one-story and a two-story, you have one distance aside as your side setback, if you will. But if you have two-stories, you have a different distance, whereas with any other zoning district, even our single-family zoning districts, you have a side setback, regardless if you have a two-story home or a single-story home. So that is kind of part of what we want to look into. And those distances between the buildings within an R6 zoning do conflict with the expectations of higher density zoning, where typically you see setbacks around the perimeter from adjoining streets and properties, more so than larger setbacks internally, which is what we currently have.
Any other questions for any other commissioners? I have a question.
Sure.
Does this also setback zoning also goes for a mixed development, such as a retail on a lower level and probably apartments or loft or something on the upper levels?
Sure. Vice Chair Harrington, we do have our other zoning districts, like our neighborhood commercial and residential service, that have that more of a mixed use zoning districts for those. I would have to do a little bit more research on R6 if that was allowable in the R6 zoning district.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from any other of the commissioners? Commissioner Posey?
And I was just curious as to why this is to be amended. What, is there a problem or with what we have?
Sure. Vice Chair Harrington, Commissioner Posey. So we've received applications, three of which, for developing a detached or even attached low-rise, high-density product. So a villa, if you're familiar with that type of development, they're more your single-story, attached, detached units that are typically smaller. So we have a couple applications in for that, which as we were going through those reviews is when we became aware that the setback and the recreation standards aren't best suited for that housing type.
Thank you. And if it's helpful, I may add that essentially our R6 zoning district, high density, was really built around providing standards and regulating your traditional 2-to-3-story apartment complex. So down the street by Noble Hops. That's what it was designed to address. So a couple of years ago, the first one we got was at Linda Vista and Oracle. We've had 3-4 applications, and I anticipate 2 more in the future of this new product that's going up all around Phoenix and all around the Tucson metro area, where it's the casitas. Remember that term? That term that we shouldn't be repeating because it creates a lot of confusion. But it's that single-family rental that's one story doesn't comport very well with our standards. So, you know, the thought process is we should have one set of standards for the traditional apartment complex and perhaps maybe even another set of standards for this situation. It's a different product. It's unique. And it's wanting to go a step further to make sure that we're addressing that appropriately.
Did that answer your question, Commissioner Posey?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. I have one additional question. Have we had much feedback from any developers on this particular topic and issues? Any feedback on their side?
Sure, Vice Chair Harrington. So the applicants, the developers of those three applications is aware we are asking for initiation tonight because we've had comments back and forth with them about meeting the current setback and recreation requirements. So they are aware.
Thank you. Any additional questions for the staff? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Sims.
Oh, there is a motion with this item. I don't know if you were.
I'd like to call a motion for this item.
So obviously the market has changed. I think we need to respond to that. And so I move to initiate the zoning code amendment to research and possibly revise the R6 zoning district setbacks.
Can I get a secondary motion for that?
Second.
Ms. Sakona, what do you call a roll call?
Commissioner Bergsma?
Aye.
Commissioner Henderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harrington?
Aye.
Commissioner Posey?
Aye.
Commissioner Sturman?
Aye.
And Chair Gamble?
Aye. And I want to second what Hal said, or Commissioner Bergsma said as well, that I think this is, you know, definitely something that's needed and will be great for all of the newer developments that we are starting to see.
Thank you, Chair Gamble. Next, we'll move on to the next item. Ms. Acona.
Discussion regarding an update on town growth and the remaining land supply.
Don't go too far.
Go to the next, it'll start it.
All right.
There you go.
Do I need to do anything here? Okay. All right. Not only is Ms. Sims helping me get started technically, I do want to acknowledge that Ms. Sims did all the real work involved with this presentation. And so I'm very, very appreciative of her efforts. You did get a copy of this presentation in your packet. And I'm going to go through it fairly quickly and try to make some sense of it. There are a lot of numbers in here, and I don't want to get too bogged down in the minutiae of those numbers. Just really, it's backing up to the grand points that we're finding. And I do want to, as much as you deem appropriate, Chair, like to make this as conversational as possible. And presenting these facts and figures, I definitely don't want to come across as the person that knows it all about Oro Valley growth. There's a lot of things in here that you can interpret many different ways, and it's all valid. It's all good. Good conversation points. All right, so this is kind of the organization of the presentation. I'm going to march through. And unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot to say about the census. It's been an odd year in many ways, more ways than one that we usually focus on. One of the oddities is the census. We've gotten little dribbles of information from the census, not the real meat that we're looking for in terms of demographics and income data and whatnot. We've got mostly macro numbers, and so that's why, relative to census, I only have one slide. So the information we're getting is fairly limited and still waiting for that, but the big punchline here is relative to you know, the pattern you see from back starting in the 80s, growth is slowing down in Oro Valley in terms of our population draw, but oh my gosh, it's still high. You know, when you compare that 15% jump since 2010 relative to what was seen regionally in Pima County, at some 6%, 6.5%, that's still a big bump. Oro Valley is used to big bumps, and you can see certainly in years past, 2010, there's been some huge bumps. Oh my gosh, bumps. But still, the number did pop up quite a bit over the last 10 years. And you can see some of the stats relative to housing. I mean, there's no surprise that, you know, those bump ups in population also... housing followed in roughly the same proportions to what we're seeing with our neighbors in Pima County. So this is a map that you saw last year relative to development and where we are. So the build-out numbers have shifted some. So we are at roughly... you know, a point where 95% of the land is just off the slate for development. And that's a very broad category. That includes truly conserved open space that can't be developed. It's protected, as well as built areas. And another nuance to this is planned areas. Those are the areas in blue on the map. Those are areas that where a plat's been approved, or a commercial development plan's been approved. It's just waiting to get built. So that's why, you know, it's off the table in terms of future development because it's already slated. So that comprises some 94%. And in terms of areas that you may see in terms of potential development and discussion, might not, you know, there's no assurance, but it could be as high as 6%. I sincerely doubt it would ever get there because most of that is only suitable for large lot residential in terms of locations. So you can see those blue areas sprinkled mainly on the outskirts of town and really hangs toward the very northern, eastern, and western corners. In terms of open space, and this was a great topic, I believe, last time we were up here, that folks really wanted to dive into the breakdown of what are the aspects of open space in Oro Valley. So 1% increase since the last time we were here a year ago, and it's mainly relative to some of the subdivisions coming online and being built now. You can see the list on the screen. Tranquillo, Shannon 80, and Capella all had sizable areas of open space that were conserved. For example, Shannon 80, close to 50% of the area was conserved as open space, as well as Capella. So the way that breaks down in terms of open space, you can see the colors at the bottom of the screen. We are very dependent on our HOAs to protect open space, their conservation easements under our different HOAs' control. Rancho Vistosa, of course, is the principal one. In Rancho Vistosa, I believe roughly 50% of Rancho Vistosa is open space. Most of that is owned by... I don't know if I can say most of it. A fair chunk of it is by the Rancho Vistosa HOA, but Pima County recently, with the development of Valley Vista and Tranquillo areas, those rezonings, was granted an enormous amount of that entire area of Big Wash between Tangerine and Rancho Vistosa Boulevard and north of Rancho Vistosa Boulevard to state land. So you can see how the other numbers stack up along with public parks at 6%. In terms of built areas, there's been a bump up of some 2 to 3%, 1% rather, and that's mainly reflective of all the activity that you saw at the end of Moore Road from Rancho Vistosa Boulevard as it goes east toward the Wash, Big Wash. So, and you can see the other developments that contributed to that number. We are a single-family residential-dominated community. That is the screamingly high number of 64%, and I think it's particularly noteworthy when you compare that to the area of commercial, 2%. It would seem those ratios are fairly favorable to commercial. The trick is the density associated with that ratio for some commercial developments isn't quite enough to help them be successful. I want to talk a little bit about, of those lots, who is Oro Valley? You know, what sizes are we seeing in terms of those residential developments? And I've heard in many neighborhood meetings, folks identify Oro Valley in different ways. We're a large lot community. Now we're more of a medium density community. Well, here are the numbers. The majority of our lots in Oro Valley, I think, are appropriately described as medium density residential. That's the 6,000 to about 11,000 square foot range. And when you look at the combination between the small and the medium, there's not a huge spread in that square footage range. That represents 66% of Oro Valley. We do still have a very large share of lots greater than a quarter acre, some 32%. So I found these stats pretty interesting and when you do get a medium density residential development in front of you, As far as a plot, it might be helpful to know that that also reflects of what most of Oro Valley is, medium density residential. Now let's talk about more about residential, and you probably remember this slide from last year, where you know it really gives kind of a layout of over the years, and we labeled different periods of time informally, you know, as far as Oro Valley's big boom period. And you can see the permits started going down dramatically as we headed to the 2008 Great Recession, and then the recovery as of 2013. You know, I kind of started this presentation by saying this has been an odd year. I want to punctuate that even louder relative to building permits. Look at that number, 2021, 497. Where on earth did that come from? During COVID, backlog of construction materials, tightening markets. Suddenly out of the blue, we're seeing, or we saw, permit level activity that we hadn't seen since maybe 2004. Huge. Very odd. Where did that come from? Well, I can tell you where it came from. It came from several rezonings that happened back in 2016, and that created a pipeline. And those were rezonings, I think, were before most of you's service time on the commission, and those came through and are all just about fully constructed at this point. So that is directly reflective again, having a pipeline. Right now, Oro Valley is not building a pipeline. Okay? So there have not been many, probably can count them on one hand, number of residential rezonings over the last 4 or 5 years of size to create a bump like that in the future. So to give you an idea where we are today, you know, for this year up through November, we're at about 91 permits. Last year, we were close to 350-ish at this point in time. So we're going to see numbers dropping back down. And Ms. Sims did a great job of trying to, in working with our permitting team, pull out the crystal ball, look at existing subdivisions that may have empty lots and whatnot, and try to guesstimate absorption and what our future numbers might look like. So last year, that incredibly high number, 497, what you can see are the numbers we're guesstimating over the next several years. And those numbers are declining. And again, I think that's just the pattern we're going to see in Oro Valley, period. Again, we're not building a pipeline like we did back in 2016, because there just isn't that level of land left. What we have today left are mainly smaller lots that are extremely challenging to build, and we're going to see smaller size subdivision proposals. So the days of the 200 to 300 unit subdivision for Oro Valley in terms of approvals is gone. We're going to see mainly 15, 30, 40 lot type subdivisions in the future. All right. So in terms of some of those projections and locations in terms of where we do see growth, and most of these are already areas that have been permitted. Okay. They've been through the pipeline. They've have plat, they have the zoning. So you can see the circles on the map, in terms of areas of highest concentration, that are going to bring those permits that we just looked at. So, perhaps the biggest area of concentration, La Cholla-Naranja, La Cholla-Lambert area, That was a rezoning done, again, back in around 2016, that was known as Capella, that, you know, accommodated close to 600 units. We're just starting to see ground broken there in terms of subdivision development, and I certainly expect that to accelerate. The development community, the major builders, are hungry to find more land. So these areas that are circled, the only one that isn't bought by a developer and fully ready to start grading and permitting is that Capella area. I imagine that land costs a lot of money because it's so rare to find anything of that size in Oro Valley. It's the last of it. So the 227 number you see up close to the word Rancho Vistoso, that's a subdivision called Tranquillo. I believe Pulte has purchased that. They're grading now and prepping the site. That's pretty well across the street from Sun City, right under or near the bridge, Rancho Vistoso Bridge across Big Wash. So those are really the more dramatic areas of change. And, of course, westward look when they move forward in terms of development in their area. We have not gotten any word that they're ready to do so. So we don't have a timeline associated with that. In terms of unplanned vacant areas, most of those of what we have today are either large lot residential. It's a pretty high number there, 49%. Or tech park and commercial. So we very often get a lot of requests to convert tech park to something else. And this is why. It's because there's not a lot of land for the more traditional uses like residential and whatnot. So there's pressure there. And the town has been fairly diligent in maintaining those for employment use in the future. But that's why we get so much pressure to convert Tech Park. The large lot residential areas not so conducive relative to higher density subdivisions in the future. There may be a few opportunities, but they're pretty limited. You know, what we anticipate seeing are areas, it was mentioned earlier in the previous agenda item, at First and Tangerine, where folks are looking to repurpose some of those commercial areas for rental units. And that particular product, you know, not only in that area, I certainly expect in the future that'll all come before you. I expect three of those projects along La Cholla to come along in the near future. So, all right. So key takeaways. I'm going to say it again. It's been an odd year, particularly relative to housing construction. And we're getting more constrained relative to 6% remaining. And the one thing that I really want everyone to leave with, because I hear this so many times, that, okay, Oro Valley is just about done in terms of land consumption. Growth is going to stop. We're done. That's not the case at all. So what happens in a community when vacant land starts to be very limited is redevelopment starts. Okay, so think of any major city. I'm sure all over the Portland areas, what you start seeing is redevelopment. People looking at areas where there are buildings and start asking, what if? Oro Valley Marketplace is our first sizable redevelopment project. We're going to start seeing more of that over the future. And so what redevelopment brings is a lot more intensity in terms of not just the land use, but also in the process. Redevelopment only happens around in developed areas where there are already neighbors, right? They're usually areas with a lot of activity. So there are more issues, there's more traffic, there's more concern. Redevelopment generally means, think about different cities, people going more vertical, okay, within limited space. Those are all realities. You know, whether it's we start seeing that in 10 years' time or 20 years' time, you know, that's the reality Oro Valley is going to face into the future. And so whether it's, you know, beyond my time, 10 to 20 years from now, that's the type of planning that Oro Valley needs to start thinking about. Because redevelopment, regardless whether you have a plan for it, it's going to happen. And it's better to have a plan for it rather than taking those on one at a time and trying to figure them out. So with that, I'll close chair, and certainly if there's any conversation, I'd love to have it. So.
Commissioner Posey.
Yes. A couple of questions.
Please.
First of all, and this may not even be, you know, to the issue here, but this single-family resident, the trends here, where 15% is small lots and 4,000 to 6,000 square foot. And then we go to the 51% medium lots, 6,000 to 10,895. That, to me, that I just, and then the larger lots, 1/4 acre, that just don't, you know, it seems like a small amount. I was wondering, how is this determined to be in these categories?
Ah, so the labels small, medium versus large, purely subjective. You can open a book and say, this is what a small lot is, okay? We tried it. So there's purely subjective in terms of ranges that we see in Oro Valley. These are the ranges that we typically fall within. So wish I had a more magic answer for you, but it's entirely subjective. So
just curious.
It's a good question.
That was
good question.
Also, are we still on thinking of annexation?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Are we still considering annexation?
Yes, if I may, Vice Chair, so the town does have an adopted annexation plan. And out of that plan, that was the source of the activity for Westward Look. So, you know, that plan does include areas such as the Casas Adobe Shopping Center, where you have the Whole Foods, and that intersection area. It also includes state land, Tangerine, and head out toward Thornydale, as well as to the north, which is all state land. That state land area to the north is roughly the size of Rancho Vistoso. It's a large piece of land. So, you know, those are all potentials in the future. Annexation, I think a misnomer about annexation that I hear often is that towns, cities, jurisdictions go out there and can annex at will. They can just go Pac-Man areas and bring them in. It's actually a very democratic process. So someone has to, a majority of the people have to want to be annexed. So to annex a property, you have to have 50% by area and number of folks saying, yes, I want to. So annexation is very much driven by working with a property owner and having a mutual discussion and finding if there's mutual benefit in annexing. So, and we do that. We do reach out to those other property owners and test the waters. So.
I can see why.
Correction for you, buyer. It's 50% by number and value.
And
it's
value.
Not area.
Got it. Thank you.
It's based on value. You have to have greater than 50% of the value. and greater than 50% of the people sign on for an annexation. Both have to be met. So, yeah, you can have a huge area and one owner. It's easy to annex if the one person signs. But if you have three areas and one's big and two of them are tiny and two of them don't sign, it doesn't happen because two of the people wanting to be annexed decided not to sign your petition.
I can see the disadvantages and the advantages of that because you get police and fire protection, and but you do have to pay higher taxes, so that's, you know, not good.
Yes.
But I guess maybe the state land, and you wouldn't have these issues on the state land of having to ask anybody.
It's really, if I may, Vice Chair, it's really no different than working with a private property owner in that sense. So yes, state land has to agree to be annexed. So they're an entity that has that yes/no aspect. So every annexation is a discussion. It's a negotiation. So,
thank you so much.
Sure.
Any other commissioners with any questions? Mr. Bergman.
Thank you. Getting back to Member Posey's question about how you draw the line between small, medium, and large, I think it depends on where you're from. If you're from West Texas, but, you know, my concern is with having sufficient, what's now called, I guess, workforce housing. You know, we want to grow jobs in this community, but the real question in my mind is, okay, we get the jobs, then where do the people live that have mm-hmm. those jobs? And, you know, if they're put in a position, and, you know, a lot of the people that get jobs here maybe can't afford a single-family home on a large lot or even a medium-sized lot, so where do they go? And I think in too many cases they may end up having to go out of town, have a fairly long commute every day, and as a consequence they add to the traffic in the mm-hmm. community, coming into and going out of the community. And so that's something I think we need. I mean, we talk about all these small lot, you know, the kind of thing that Ms. Sims was talking about, the low-rise, high-density housing that's being proposed. Yeah, that'll generate trips, but it probably, if those people are working in the community, are not going to be driving very far. In fact, they might even not even drive. They might ride their bike or even walk. So there may be trips, but they may not be the kind of trips that generate a lot of traffic overall. So that's the kind of thing we need to consider as we're looking at higher density. You know, is it affordable? Is it meeting the needs of employees in the community? Those things need to be considered. Mm-hmm. One question I have about multifamily, and again, we're talking about places where that might be considered workforce housing, is how much acreage do we have? I know we have a projection of 1,166 units on the remaining undeveloped land for multifamily, but how much acreage is that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. You trailed off a little bit there.
Yeah, do we know how much acreage there is for multifamily at this point for undeveloped acreage?
I think that's one we'd have to research a bit and follow up.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah, glad
to. I want to get a sense of how much we have left, because I have the sense we don't have a lot and we may need more.
Yeah.
Okay.
So is the question, what are our current opportunities for high-density residential zoning-wise today?
Basically, yes.
Yeah, got it. They're very limited. So it's predominantly that R6 zoning district, and there are just a few sites left along Oracle. So that would be a very quick research project because there's not very much of it. So, but glad to circle back.
Sure. And in terms of redevelopment, and you sort of emphasized that, what kind of redevelopment would you foresee happening? I mean, obviously, the demand for brick-and-mortar retail is declining. because of what everybody calls the Amazon effect. So is that a place where we might look at changing the use to something that is in more demand, like higher density residential?
Vice Chair, Member Bergsma, I think it really fits hand in glove with your last point and question about high density and the availability of R6. So it's mixed-use development. So you're bringing the customers to your doorstep. So, you know, definitely foresee as part of redevelopment, wanting to do a deeper dive or need to do a deeper dive zoning-wise to facilitate mixed use in the way the town wants to see it. So it's bringing in residential, it's bringing in experiential type commercial versus your traditional brick and mortar retail, as you mentioned. So, and those are some of the things that, you know, Oro Valley Marketplace was trying to mix in. But, you know, I think going forward for the future, you know, a higher level of planning to accommodate needs to be done. So when someone comes in, there's a more of a recipe of what the town wants to see. So, you know, I think that's an important next step.
So. One word you often hear along with redevelopment is infill. And as I'm sure you know, City of Tucson recently adopted an ordinance allowing for accessory dwelling units in all their single-family zones. And that was, you know, a fairly contentious process. I was involved in it. But they finally got there. And, you know, I'm just sort of putting a bug in the ear of staff and maybe the mayor and vice mayor as well. That's something that probably, you know, in conjunction with the housing study that you're going to be doing next year, you need to look at seriously. Accessory dwelling units, I think, could fit in some of the neighborhoods in the community, especially those on those lots that are moderate to large in size. So it's something, you know, it's you know, if you have ever read the book written by Dan Perolik, the guy that invented the term missing middle housing, mm-hmm. you know, his basic point is this is housing that fits within the neighborhood. It doesn't really look out of place. It's there. It certainly meets a need, but it doesn't have a major effect. And I think that's something that might work in Oro Valley, and I hope it's considered. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
No, that's very helpful.
Thank you, Commissioner Bergsma. Ms. Sims?
Thank you. Commissioner Bergsma, just to follow up on your first question. So the amount of planned vacant land and vacant without any development plan of multifamily residential, so that's our R4, R6, senior care's in there, is roughly 121 acres remaining.
Thank you. So 121 acres, and you're projecting about 1,166 units resulting from that based on what you have in the presentation?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So if not to beat that point to death, but it's also, as you know, Commissioner Bergsma, it's the next question is how usable are those acres? I mean, are those small bits here and there? And my sense is they by and large are, versus being larger areas where you can do anything of magnitude. So quantity and quality, right? So
absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Demand will call for people not to travel so much where they have to come in. And we just don't seem to have the transient system, you know, that brings them in. So for the redevelopment, I think multi-stories are going to have to be considered a little bit more because we don't seem to, you know, have that grasp, but it's a horrible thing. But mm-hmm. I see it as a positive if we're talking about redevelopment.
If I may, Vice Chair, I think it's, you know, it's a good point, Mr. Sturman, and It's location, 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 right? So as far as where is it appropriate, where is it not appropriate? So those are important discussions, and that discussion is going to come more and more to the fore, as whether it's 10 years, 20 years time, again, as redevelopment and land is more scarce. So, there's an age-old saw, particularly in Arizona. This whole, our region is famous for it, is avoidance of density, but sprawling outward. Keep going outward. Keep going outward. And the subsequent loss of open spaces because of that. So, and that's where, I do try to respectfully to those who feel that there is an option just to stop growth. Growth finds a way, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, it does. And so you have to figure out how to accommodate it. It's coming. I think a great example that I know Commissioner Bergner is aware of, Portland drew a ring around the city and said, no, that's it, no more growth. It finds ways to appear elsewise. It starts going vertical. Folks find ways to, move it outside the city limits. And so, it really is a false choice to declare no growth in my mind. And I don't want to come across as I'm Mr. Pro-Growth up here pounding that. That's not it. It's how do you constructively accommodate it and not lose the character that folks cherish. So that's the dance. That is the dance. So,
any other questions for commissioners?
Vice Chair Harrington?
Yes, Chair Gamble, go ahead.
All right, thank you. I just, I want to thank Ms. Sims and Mr. Beyer for the presentation and the information that they provided. And I just kind of wanted to echo the sentiments that Commissioner Sturman and Bergsma had in terms of, high density and providing. And I think one of those things where we have like a great opportunity to provide some high density is that Oro Valley Marketplace. And, I think our commission mostly agrees that, there's definitely a community need for that. And that, that type of location is a great place to have some vertical redesign. And so I was, not super surprised when I saw the numbers, because I think we kind of see that a lot where we get so many requests for, multiple stories and, just finding the right locations for it. And I was really thrilled with how the marketplace was redesigned and reimaged. And, I think that would be just a huge asset for the town to have in terms of these numbers when you look at them and, the very limited amount of space that we have. And, I think what Mr. Vella said, where growth will happen because there's the demand for it. And Oro Valley is such an amazing community. You can see that in the numbers where we have the bump in, a sizable bump in people over, considering we are a small town, but we're a very desirable town to live in. So I was just, glad to see these numbers. I think, for the most part, our commission is doing a really great job. Kind of feeling out what the community wants. And so good job for all of us and, kind of seeing some of the things that we've passed and how they support the numbers. So that was interesting to see. And yeah, I look forward to see what we have coming. I know we've got lots on the plate, so that'll be exciting to see. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gamble. Any other follow-up questions for the commissioners? Commissioner Burson.
Thank you. One other thought.
is obviously we have a fairly large population of older adults in this community, and a lot of those people are part-timers, snowbirds, or maybe they live here the majority of the time, but they're gone maybe during the summer to escape the heat. And so I know you're going to be looking more carefully at this as more census numbers come out, but you know, what's your sense of how that affects growth in this community and affects demand for residential development?
That's a great question. So, you know, it'd be interesting to look at, relook at the numbers relative to the amount of in-migration, people that are coming into this area for the first time. And so, as you experienced firsthand, you chose Oro Valley from afar, very deliberately. And so we're going to keep seeing that. The challenge is, as prices go up, the apartment rental rates continue to rise. And so the question will be availability, affordability. So, and that's where, you know, and I know you're very involved with the city of Tucson's effort. Those are things we need to look at. Those are things we need to look at to provide more opportunities, non-traditional opportunities. So, don't seeing that abate one bit. It just will be a lot more expensive. But folks will find a way to come here.
Thank you.
Chair.
Commissioner Sturdivant.
Thank you. You know, one of the things, Byer, that I'm kind of reflecting on is here, you know, we keep talking about open space or land available for us to really develop. I kind of think that we need to also consider the fact is water. Will we have enough water to sustain this type of population growth? Mm-hmm. Even though we think that annexation may be the answer, vertical development may be the answer, but there's going to be a strain point where the water, that is going to be a key issue. Either we grow or we don't grow or flatten out. Can you reflect on that a little bit, or
sure.
Maybe I'm missing the point?
No, you're definitely not missing the point. It's a very good point. So every year, our Oro Valley Water Utility does an analysis relative to supply, demand, and projecting needs out. And they sit down with us, the planning team, and we go through these permit projection numbers with them and different scenarios. Relative to what is build out, and then they extrapolate water need versus supply. And we do that once a year because it's dynamic, right? Using a crystal ball. So the town has an assured 100-year water supply, which is required of all municipalities within an active water management area with the Arizona Department of Water Resources. So we track those numbers. So in the developments, all the developments we've brought before you are within our capacity, and we're not butting up against that very edge. I can't recall the exact numbers. But to your point, if we were to annex Arroyo Grande, the state land area north of Estoso, that's the size of Estoso, that raises a lot of water questions. So that would involve figuring out different water resources, no question. So, but at least in terms of the foreseeable future within town limits, the planning has been very solid. And that's something, again, that's reanalyzed on a regular basis. So it's an issue that's taken very seriously. And Community Academy, as you know, we typically have the water director provide a class on this very thing. And so certainly if any of you would like to audit, you're more than welcome. to hear a deeper dive on that very topic. So I'm glad to share the schedule with you guys. And if you want to drop in any or all, just let us know. So.
All right. I think I have a few questions here that I was writing down some notes. My question is, the first one is developers. How are they made aware of some of the infield land that's still available? Do we put it on our website, or are they just on their own to find out those locations?
A little bit of both, Vice Chair. So the lands that the town is very interested in promoting, and that's the employment land. We have a fairly developed website that lists those properties and information to connect those people to the actual agent selling those properties and links to the zoning and whatnot. So that's the tech park zoned areas throughout the community. So we're very forward and wanting to court that type of activity. When it comes to residential development and commercial development, brokers, and more brokers. So probably 50% of my phone calls during a week that I receive are from brokers. You know, I'm looking at this, and this. Is that permitted? Or what do it take to get it permitted? That is a significant amount of time that our team spends on answering those types of questions. In terms of residential development, most folks are in the know that there aren't any large sites left in Oro Valley. So it really is looking at niche parcels, and they take more time and care with brokers and developers because they're the ones with the most slope. They may have the most drainage issues, or they had the most problematic traffic situations. The land price has gone up, and also the amount of planning required has gone up because of the difficulty in what's left. So it's a little bit of both.
Okay, thank you. One of my next questions is one of the slides where it says single family homes. There's a 250 number for single-family homes near the Ina, near the Westwood Look area. Is that 250 homes, or is that for multifamily?
Multifamily.
Okay. It was on a single-family homes line.
Right. So, I misspoke. Definitely not single-family.
Okay. Not. I just wanted to make sure,
sure.
That I was aware of that. One of my next questions is, on the infill growth, I'm sure that this may come up later in some of the plans, townhomes or triplexes in some of those smaller lots. And of course, they're going to be trying to be building taller in some of these smaller lots. Does the town foresee any policy changes with such as like townhomes next to some single family, single story homes that may come down the pike?
Townhomes? No. Which is surprising to me. So the last new townhome project was in Ranch Vistoso at the intersection of Moore and Ranch Vistoso Boulevard. I believe that was Mattamy. And that was seen as a bold move. They were the first in the area to dip their toe back in because townhomes are more of a thing, I think, perhaps more in the 90s. 80s and 90s, and that, a lot of our stock was built back then. So, in speaking with principals of Mattamy, they definitely saw it as a risk, and were willing to take it, and the two end units sold immediately. They had a hard time selling all the ones in between. Even though the design is much smarter these days, thicker walls, you line up a garage to a garage versus someone's bedroom in terms of, you know, trying to dampening noise. But the perception's there. If you're a middle unit, you're going to hear your neighbors. They're harder to sell. So I think a lot of builders were watching Mattamy and they struggled a little bit. So, So I think it's this single family, small rental product that's detached. Because of that stigma, there's a common wall stigma about hearing your neighbors. That is taken off like wildfire. It really has. It's they're all over the Tucson area, very much popping everywhere in Phoenix, and they're just discovering Oro Valley. So,
the reason why I ask, I'm quite aware. I was on a different board when that came across, so I'm aware of that particular project. Yeah. And of course, my next line of question is triplexes and duplexes in the same metaphor as townhomes, but it kind of ties into one another.
You know, Vice Chair, let me correct myself. So we actually have a duplex project on the boards right now in Ranch Vistoso that'll be coming before you. Morning Vista and Ranch Vistoso Boulevard. So not too far off from right across from the golf course from Stone Canyon. So odd, strange piece that's been vacant. And it's zoned high-density residential. All one story. They have the ability to go two-story. They have the zoning to go to two-story. But market-wise, aren't interested. They felt they could get a higher value, quicker sale at one story. So that's more than likely going to be in front of you in the next 2 to 3 months. So,
okay, thank you. Any other commissioners with any other questions?
Just one more.
Commissioner Posey.
Thank you. I was just wondering, due to the high increase of building materials, I was wondering what your thoughts are on this being an immediate issue.
You know, it's what's interesting. Vice Chair actually probably knows more about that than I do. But, you know, and speaking with developers, what I keep hearing, please correct me, Vice Chair, is it costs more, it takes more time, but we can also charge more. And people aren't blinking an eye about paying it. They're still selling, and folks are selling out. So that pain of waiting, that goes back to my comment, it's been an odd year. Look at those permit numbers. The absorption rate of subdivisions is really high, despite the cost of lumber, despite the fact that you have to wait forever to even get a washing machine, et cetera, that they were experiencing. Vice Chair, do you want to add?
Sure. The cost per square foot is $200 a square foot right at the current moment. So the cost is high, and it's going to level out, but it's potential what's going on in the world. It could peak even higher, but I don't foresee it. The cost of building going down. So that's going to be a long term, and I don't think it's going down whatsoever.
Thank you.
If I could add, the University of Arizona program, the MAP program, I think it's Making Action Possible. They have usually something in the Daily Star every Sunday. I believe this last week, and they had a graphic that showed affordability in different jurisdictions in the West. And Tucson's still one of the most affordable areas, even though prices are going up significantly relative to other areas, such as Portland or certainly San Diego, places like that. We're still pretty affordable. We're one of the more affordable areas in the West. So, yeah, it's getting more expensive, but, you know, so is every place else. So it's still, we're still a very attractive location for people to locate in.
It's a good perspective.
Any other questions for any other commissioners? All right. Hearing none, go to our planning update.
Vice Chair Harrington, we have one more item.
Sorry, last agenda item, sorry.
Discussion regarding summarizing findings prior to a formal vote.
All right. Next item. Formal vote.
Thank you, Vice Chair. This is an item that I've had a few conversations with the chair and vice chair about, and it's purely meant as a constructive suggestion that through the discussion of various recent cases, particularly ones of high interest, you all know what I'm talking about. Something to think about or consider is that and usually most of us, do a really good job of this, is kind of spreading your thought process, sharing your thought process before a motion. So, usually the motions will, provide a suggestion, refer back to the general plan. But if there are any other, significant points that you think are, so the folks in the audience understand perhaps where you're coming from. Whether it's a yes vote or a no vote. So, in the past, when folks, may have voted no on an item, one of the worst positions I feel in terms of community service is when someone asks me, well, why did so-and-so vote no? And my response is, I don't know. So, and it's not an ask, and I don't, when I come across as putting anyone in the position of, we expect you to do a dissertation and regurgitate everything you can think of relative to the case. Please don't do that. But just, to share a little bit, particularly when you have folks listening, whether it's in person or online, in the spirit of transparency, this... this commission does a great job. I think it's just one of those areas that maybe we can go a step further. So, Vice Chair, did you want to add anything, or did I already put my foot in it?
No, I think I can help with this because we've had discussions on this item here. And, of course, if you feel very sternly about a particular project or zoning issue there, definitely speak up. You don't have to elaborate too much in detail if you don't want to, but definitely – for the general public, they would like to know, why did you, your stance is yes or no? For me, I've had a couple of items that I felt very strongly about, and I elaborated a little bit why my reasoning for it was. I didn't go into too hard of detail, but certain things I feel strong, certainly about certain items, and that's, it's only good to be transparent and give that information to the general public and make it on the record. Either a yes vote, I'm strongly for X, Y, and Z, or, that particular project I don't agree with for X, Y, and Z. You don't have to go in too much detail, but definitely, make your voice heard. And I think that's part of the process, and just being transparent and say, I don't like that because, the building's too tall or too short, or, I just don't feel the color works out well for that particular project. But just make yourself, outspoken and known for whatever the yes or no is, without going to too much of a statement or thing of that nature.
Chair Harrington, may I speak?
Yes. Thank you.
This is refreshing because I never knew that we could do that. I thought it was either a yes or no, however we, we look toward it. So I really enjoy hearing this because there's a few things that I do want to say that not that, not outrageous, but it was just the the freedom, to say some of the reasons why that I voted the way I did. Mm-hmm. Second point that I wanted to make, I have to say that I've been trained to do this. I was under the impression that first thing, you make a motion for either not approval or so forth, and then you have a discussion, and this is how you vote. It's not the idea that we talk about all this and then we make a motion. Now, which is right? I was under the impression that you're supposed to make a motion and then you discuss it.
Great question. And Mr. Andrews will be our Sherpa here on this one, but my understanding is you want to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Mr. Sturman, you're correct. The proper way to do it is make a motion and then have discussion, because that way most of the rules actually come into effect, one of which is in case you just, and I'm not saying it's ever happened, but if you have somebody that goes on and you want to call the question, you have to have a question. So if you have a deep discussion before the motion, you can't call the question. So the best thing to do is have a motion and then discussion, but it's been over the years, many times people want to have the discussion before the question. And one other thing, I got to put a footnote on the wet blanket attorney. If you're going to tell people what you think about a project because you're going to vote yes or no, please base it in something substantial. It can never be arbitrary and capricious, because if it is, then I'm going to be stuck with the litigation. You can't say I don't like it because Bill's on the board. I don't like it because it's banana yellow. You have point to code, point to policy, point to something, and then make your position. I have no problem with you making a position. I just hate having, well, I felt it was ugly. I can't defend that. But I can defend it doesn't meet our design guidelines in ABC. I'm all over that. Great example.
Thank you, Mr. Andrews. And I think we have another question here, Commissioner.
So as I think all of you know, I am a retired planner, and I did on occasion provide staff support to planning commissions in the past. And they do it different ways. But the one that I thought did the best job, and I think you can go either way, have the discussion after the motion is made or before, you know, either way would probably be okay. But this commission, the chair would always ask individual members what they thought. Go down the line, you know, in whatever order you want to go in. Give them a chance to speak. Maybe they don't want to say anything. That's fine. Or if they do, you know, give them as much time as they want, as long as they don't ramble on too long. But that way, you know, it's sort of a deliberate process. That there is a point in the meeting after the hearing has been completed where the commission really talks. And so I think that might be something that the chair or the vice chair, who's ever running the meeting, would want to consider, just sort of saying, Commissioner Bergstrom, what do you think? Or Commissioner Sturman, what do you think? Or Commissioner Posey, you know, so, sort of go down the line. And of course chair, vice chair would have the opportunity to do that as well. So I think that might be something you want to think about doing.
Very good.
Thank you, Commissioner. One of the things also is when we have the discussion ahead of time, maybe there's another commissioner that may have that same question that you're thinking about and may help either answer that question, or you may have something to add to that. So the perfect time before we do the motion, say, you know what, I'm going to ask this question. Maybe someone else has the same question, good to get it out there and discuss it before you actually make the motion and vote on it.
Thank you for mentioning that, Vice Chair, because I too wanted to encourage and make sure that everyone knows staff very much welcomes your questions, okay? We want to hear questions, so there's no, oh my gosh, you know, they're picking on me. That's where we're here. So, and all of you, and I really appreciate this, you know, when you have a very deep dive type question, you give us a heads up so we can do that research for you. And by all means, even if we've provided you the answer, it's perfectly appropriate to ask the question and encouraged to ask the question in public. So the public can hear it too. That's part of your thinking. So perfectly appropriate. And just want to make sure everyone knows that the welcome mat is open when we're standing up here and asking those questions. So,
is there any other commissioners online have any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you. Now we'll do planning update.
All right. Miss Ancona, who always keeps me in line on everything, including planning update, sent me my marching orders, and I am looking those up. All right. Tell you what, it's 8 p.m. Let's go ahead and forego that. I don't have a laundry list beyond. We will be back the next commission meeting with the R6 code amendment and also the sign code amendment. And we're going to take a little bit more time on the development review process code amendment. We're still asking different stakeholders their opinions and formulating code. So that'll be more of a slow comeback so that we can be thorough and deliberative. I do want to let y'all know that we did interview for a commissioner yesterday. That was so long ago. Yesterday and tomorrow night at council, there's a host of board and commission members being put forth names for a vote. So so stay tuned. We will likely have an announcement tomorrow. And we'll certainly work on getting training going and whatnot. And the gentleman's name is Joe Nichols. Who's being proposed, and look forward to introducing Mr. Nichols next go-round. Thanks.
Okay. Can I get a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
Motion adjourned.